Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother and co-host is not with us today, but she will be joining us again next week. But instead, or in addition, I mean, we always have another guest in addition to my mother. And our guest today is Rachel Kushner, author of The Mars Room. Rachel is the best-selling author of The Flamethrowers, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and the Folio Prize and a New York Times Top 10 book of 2013. Her first novel, Telex from Cuba, was also a finalist for the National Book Award and was reviewed on the cover of the New York Times. She is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and other awards, and her fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, and Harper's. Rachel lives in Los Angeles, and welcome to Writer's Voices.
Thanks very much.
So, Rachel, how long have you been writing books?
Well, I mean, I've been writing books since, you know, the books I've written were in formation and then published. So it's not like I wrote other books that weren't published. I have the three novels, which you named Telex from Cuba, The Flamethrowers, and then my new book, The Mars Room. My first novel came out in 2008. My new book came out last year. It takes me about 5 years to write each book, although my first novel took longer, I think, because I was trying to figure out how to write a novel.
So did you start around 2001, something like that?
With that novel?
Yeah, with that first novel.
Yeah, that book took me about 7 years to write. Yeah, but your question is phrased in a way like, you know, when did you start writing books? I mean, I think a writer's gestation can be kind of mysterious, or certain parts of it aren't so obvious. I didn't always try to write novels, although I wanted to be a writer. I was working on shorter pieces when I was younger, which seemed easier to get my head around in terms of, you know, having a certain kind of ambition and form. The idea of a novel seemed beyond me when I was younger, and not like something I needed to embark on. It was only when I got the idea for the novel that I came to write, Telex from Cuba, that I realized this realm that I'm intrigued by, the story of the role the Americans played in the years leading up to the Cuban Revolution, seemed like the landscape of a novel. And it had to have subtlety and nuance and complexity in it, which the story of, you know, what happened in Cuba in the years before the revolution is incredibly baroque and fascinating political history. And I have known people who were sort of there for it and even to some degree witness to it, because my mother lived in Cuba as a child in a kind of quasi-colonial community that was under the aegis of the United Fruit Company, and the Americans who were there were living 10 kilometers from where Raul and Fidel Castro grew up. And they grew up kind of in the shadow of American power and, you know, American privilege. And so I thought, oh, this is really a novel. This is not a nonfiction thing. It's not an essay. So that was when I got the idea to write a novel. But prior to that, I wanted to be a writer. I just hadn't been attempting to write.
Well, I had assumed that you had started out in other forms of writing because of, you know, your bio and some of the places you were published. So I guess that was why I asked the question that way.
I still publish other things besides novel. It's not like I was training or tracking to do a different kind of writing than I ended up doing at all. The writing, I write sometimes for the New York Times Magazine and I write about art, but that was something that I was just doing on the side while trying to write longer fiction. And I still do it on the side to take a break from working on novels.
How did you decide to become a writer in the first place? I mean, was this like your first career choice and you never considered anything else, or not?
I never really, I never really considered the idea of having a career. In fact, such a thing would have been somehow unthinkable for me. I was always interested in language. I mean, I feel every writer would say that. And there's something a little cheap about saying, like, I was always a writer. I always think of how the equivalent for an artist would be, you know, oh, I always drew, but everybody draws, right? When
right,
you're little,
right.
It's not
yeah.
anything to brag about. But I was always interested in language, and I, you know, I kept a journal when I was young and wrote poetry and was a big reader. But those things don't necessarily indicate that somebody is going to end up dedicating, you know, not just their time, but their kind of their whole identity formation to literature and writing literature. For me, it happened in a kind of, I guess, a gradual way. In high school, I was interested in poetry. I did not major in English in college, which I guess is a little bit unusual. I studied political economy. This was in the late 1980s. And at that time, it seemed to me as though, like, the great moral issues and moral wars of my time were going to play themselves out in Central America, you know, after the revolution in Nicaragua and the U.S. foreign involvement in Guatemala and in El Salvador and historically in Costa Rica. I was political and I was very interested in that story and time, and so I focused on it and on economics and political science in college. And then after college, I didn't want to have any career. It was the early 1990s, and America, some may not know just because they didn't, you know, live through it or were too young to be paying attention. But, you know, the country fell into a grave recession at that time, which contributed, I think, to a certain attitude of nihilism among young people, because there were no jobs to have. But also, I didn't want a job. I just never wanted to join what I thought of as the straight world. So even though I went to a good college, UC Berkeley, when I finished, I got a job making sandwiches in a brewery. And, you know, I was a bohemian and I lived in San Francisco and kind of existed in a world where, I don't know, it was, there wasn't a lot of respect for people who, you know, got out there and handed out resumes and got jobs in offices. Like, that just wasn't on my radar at all. The idea of having a career, I don't even think I didn't admire people who wanted careers. I worked in bars. I did all kinds of stuff. But the whole time, I was kind of secretly interested in art, but kind of pursuing something seriously, like, you know, art or literature, wasn't really happening in San Francisco, where I'm from. It's kind of a small provincial place, and I moved to New York City. Because I knew that that was a place where you could meet other people who wanted to be writers and took literature seriously and be more kind of nakedly ambitious about your art. And I, you know, got a fellowship to go to a writing program there. And I had been taking writing workshops at this very kind of wonderfully unorthodox college called New College of California, which was in the Mission District in San Francisco. And the poet Lynn Hajinian, she's a language poet, taught there. And I took her classes. And it was just something I did on the side while I was a bartender. But then when I got to Columbia, I was around all these people who wanted to be writers. And I started working at a literary magazine called Grand Street. And it just kind of took off from there, I guess. But starting in my early 20s, I wanted to be a writer.
I had an interview a while back with Alan Gannett, author of The Creative Curve, to How to Be Creative. And one of the things that he says was finding the community that's doing what you want to do and that can help inspire your creativity and help it grow.
Well, I don't know if I agree with that, not to be a contrarian, but only because part of at least for me, being a novelist is luxuriating in a big buffer of solitude. And I don't necessarily find it essential to know other writers. I never did. I wanted to leave San Francisco because it was just kind of nihilistic place. But I will say that going to New York and meeting other writers, I guess, was useful for placing myself in a context. But getting a certain sort of approval. Like I had a teacher who, thought I had some potential, and I'm still friends with that person, and he kind of watched me, you know, develop as a writer, and that was useful. But I don't feel like I'm part of a social community of writers and don't really need that. I have a few friends.
Interesting, because I had gotten, you know, because you said you went to New York to sort of find that creative community, that maybe that was important to you. But
well, maybe he's right in the sense that I hung out with visual artists, and still most of my friends are artists. So, and I find them, I don't know, that world is sort of shaped around one discourse that everyone's participating in. And I find it interesting as a bystander. I guess I do find that inspiring, perhaps in opposition to this idea that creativity is inspired by a community. I think a writer to me is somebody who is at large in the world and noticing things with a particular kind of attention, and then writing out of that consciousness, and somebody who's perceptive about other people. But that's all from a distance. And I think that some of those perceptions about people and about the world can be intensified through that distance. The hubbub of a social world does not contribute for me to the power of fiction writing. It's my removal from that world that is probably an essential ingredient.
So The Mars Room just came out in paperback here in the spring of 2019. It was released in hardback about a year ago, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, 1 year, on May 1st, 2018.
And so Telex from Cuba was set in Cuba, Cuban Revolution, so it would be a historical novel, political novel. Your second book was, where was it set?
In New York and in Italy, the 1970s, the end of the manufacturing age. And we're still kind of processing the fallout from deindustrialization. And it's about the art world and a lot of artists who are, you know, still the kind of luminaries in the art world now are people who rose, like they're kind of professional ascendancy and their intellectual ascendancy happened in the 70s. Like, if you want to know anything about the art world, you have to know about the artists and the ideas and the kinds of changes that took place in the 1970s. So that whole world feels very present to me. But also that book, in a way, was written for me in dialogue with contemporary times. And there's a lot of overlap between things that happened in the book and things that happened around me while I was writing it. And there was a kind of conversation going on between the two. Like, it was a way to synthesize certain ideas in the contemporary, especially like the Occupy movement, which was happening while I was writing the book.
Well, I don't think of the 70s as history either, because I also lived through that, and the 60s as well. But I wonder where...
Also, it was a book about a young woman who moves to New York City, and like a lot of them, I've had a lot of younger women respond very strongly to the book. I mean, in a positive way, and say that they identified with it as speaking to their own experience as young women, you know, moved to a city, maybe from someplace more provincial, and the way that they were treated and the kind of the way that male voices like dominate in social environments, et cetera. So parts of it are about the time, but I don't know. I guess the term historical novel to me feels like a trap that I try to avoid.
Well, I love historical novels, but normally, I guess maybe you have to be a little, go a little further back to be considered historical. Although for somebody who lived through the 50s, that wouldn't be, they wouldn't consider that, or the 40s, maybe they wouldn't consider that historical. But anyway, let's get to the Mars Room. So the Mars Room has, is set primarily in a women's prison in California. How did you learn about enough about a women's prison to be able to write with the level of detail and authenticity that you have in the Mars Room?
Yes, the book opens when the main character, Romy Hall, is on her way from, she's being transported on a sheriff's bus from a jail in Los Angeles County to a women's prison deep in industrial farmland where our state prisons in California are sited. Once she's there, the book does jump around to, you know, her earlier life as an adult and as an adolescent in San Francisco, her life in Los Angeles right before she commits the crime that results in a double life sentence, and this experience in prison. And then there's character Gordon Hauser who comes and goes from the prison. So I like to emphasize that the book is about a world that's larger than just the prison. To me, it's a book about California. But I have gotten to know, I guess, the criminal justice system and the sort of carceral world, in a variety of ways. I knew some people growing up who went to prison. My parents had friends who'd been in prison. So I've always been aware of it. It's, to me, a dimension of reality, even if the, by structure and by design, it is to some degree invisible to, let's say, middle-class people. You don't have to think about prison, you know, when you're out running errands, picking up your dry cleaning or whatever. But if you're aware of it, or aware of sort of how society is structured, when you see, for instance, a sheriff's bus with its tinted windows on the freeway, you know that it's full of people who are being taken, you know, probably from a county jail up to a prison. And so it's just, it's something, even though invisible, I've always been aware of. And when I finished my last book in 2012, I decided I wanted to learn everything I could about the criminal justice system in California. And I live walking distance from the large criminal court complex in Los Angeles. And I have relatives who are public defenders, and I know public defenders in the city. And people said, you know, you should just go down there and watch arraignments. And this was not as a writer, but as a denizen of Los Angeles, curious about, I guess, if I could summarize two things. Why is it that the courts are public? And, you know, in principle, anyone can go down there on any weekday and watch proceedings as though it were a form of theater. And my second question was, who's being moved through this system? Who's at these arraignments? And who's attending them as support, friends and family, you know, and who are the bailiffs? And just what is the scene like? And I had been reading a lot of Janet Malcolm, and I like the way that she will notice small details about bureaucratic procedure and kind of alight upon the richness of a particular detail. And the courts are full of that in Los Angeles. And I was really struck by what happens when the long theatrical process of a trial is over. The person, you know, has a trial. They are, let's say they're convicted. Then they are sentenced. And then they are, as the state parlance goes, remanded to state prison, at which point the theater is over and the invisible part commences. So they go to begin to serve their sentence. And they are no longer seen, and there's nothing public about it, but that person continues to exist. and what is their life like inside prison? And I began volunteering with a human rights organization that works with women in the large women's prison in California. It's called Central California Women's Facility. And got to know people there, and I was working with people. I still am quite a lot, actually, working with people in various capacities, either helping them with a commutation or to prepare for parole or doing mentoring with writing. I have all kinds of friends in prison, and they mentor me in certain ways as well. And that's something that I just am doing with my quote-unquote free time, which I don't have a lot of, but I make the time. And so I guess there were things about, to answer your question, there were things about the mechanics of daily life in prison, and particularly things about what people inside those facilities do to get by, how they survive, the way they circumvent the rules, the little like tactics. There were things I would not have learned if I didn't have friends who were lifers who told me about things. But in terms of like what people think about and how they feel and the social environment and the way that people speak in prison, a lot of that is second nature. It's just common sense because I pay attention to people and how they talk. And I've known, you know, a lot of people who started entering the criminal justice system very young from growing up. So in the book, in a way, I was paying homage to people I'd known and how they dealt with it, and some of them being quite quite funny, I guess, and self-sacrificing in the way they would, you know, be willing to insult a cop or a prison guard at great risk to themselves. So, you know, some of it is, I think, just has to do with paying attention to people over the course of a life.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Rachel Kushner, author of The Mars Room. Rachel, this is actually a topic that I have a great deal of interest in. I started volunteering with a Toastmasters group in our state prison probably 20 years ago in Iowa, and befriended one of the inmates who is serving a life without parole from something that happened when he was 19. And under a sentence, the felony murder rule, which you might be familiar with, but most people are not.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. And California just recently eliminated and made retroactive the elimination of the felony murder rule. Now, the Iowa Supreme Court eliminated that when it was a single act that the charge was made on, both the felony and the death were the result of a single act. They eliminated the felony murder rule, but they did not make it retroactive. And there have been multiple court cases, and they continue to refuse to make that. They ruled it unconstitutional, but if you're already in prison for it, tough luck.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating that you mentioned, and I'm so glad to hear that you also are involved with prison work there in Iowa. Then, you know, I mean, knowing people who have, I also am close to people serving sentences of life without possibility of parole. And in one case, a young woman who doesn't have life without, only because the judge couldn't give it to her. So instead, because it would have had to have been a special circumstances murder, so-called. So instead, he gave her two life sentences, and as he specified at the sentencing hearing, not to be served concurrently, plus a six-year enhancement. And she committed her crime when she was 15 years old.
Oh my gosh.
And is now 31. And it's an entirely different situation than the narrator of my novel, The Mars Room. But I gave my narrator exactly that sentence. I don't know, it just happened, but also thinking of my friend Christy, and the idea of not to be served concurrently is, it's haunting.
Yeah.
And it led me to spend years thinking about the strange plasticity, if you will, of the life sentence, because you could live for 44 days only, and yet you would have fulfilled your commitment to the state to pay back for the harm you've committed. Or you could live for 80 years and still you would have fulfilled your commitment to the state. It's kind of incredible. And the idea that some crimes, the justice system effectively believes you need to live twice in order to fulfill your commitment to the state and pay back for the harm you've committed. But, and this is maybe getting into the weeds, but about the felony murder rule, I completely believe that if somebody was young and, you know, had been led astray by various causes and ended up in a situation where, let's say, they're riding along with somebody who, you know, does a drive-by and they weren't even handling the murder weapon, et cetera. Like, yes, that person should not be charged with murder. But I also think that people who did handle the weapon and did pull the trigger should equally be given a chance to be rehabilitated.
Yeah.
So I don't believe anyone should be serving life without possibility of parole. And most countries in the world are not putting people away for that long of a period of time. In Spain, the average sentence for murder is 7 years. And actually, it turns out that that's enough time for people in Spain to think about what they've done and figure out how they're going to live when they get out of prison. So the idea that in the United States, some people just need to think permanently and then die in prison, I don't see how that's rehabilitative.
Well, it does. It seems to me that the rehabilitative functions of prison were sort of left by the wayside a long time ago.
Yeah, I know. I think that's right.
There's very few educational opportunities anymore, at least in the state prisons here in Iowa. And they're not, the inmates are really not, you do get some good wardens who will do what they can to try and provide rehabilitative opportunities, but sometimes there just aren't any, and there's so much, there's so much we could talk about here, because one of the first things you said is that, you know, you were aware of this from a young age. I was not. Prison was something that happened to other people, not people that I knew. And I think there's a lot of people out there who think whatever, if someone's in prison, whatever they did, they deserve what they get. They're really thought of as other and of less than human and not deserving of any kindness. And it's even sometimes hard for me when I to talk to somebody about the fact that I have this friend that I'm helping in prison, because there's this connotation of, oh, he's pulling a con on you.
Or it can just be a conversation stopper.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've experienced that. Like, people don't want to hear about it. It's not nice, quote unquote, you know, and they want to think about nice things, which is not at all to, like, indict middle-class people. I understand. It's not nice.
Yeah.
But there's some way that you can just live your life and not really have to grapple with that world. And I think that once you kind of undergo a transformation where you decide to make these disappeared people, these invisibilized people, a part of your life, even if you do live like, you know, a normal kind of, I guess, middle class existence, which is blessed by the great privilege of not having to go to court and not being arrested or go to jail or prison, I think a richer life can be had in dialogue with people that the state has decided, you know, are not meant to, I don't know what I'm, sorry, it's not making much sense, but that I wanted personally to form a life that included people that are sort of erased visibly.
Right. And I think maybe part of what you were
from bourgeois life.
Maybe part of what you were saying or trying to say too was that that, like, if I do tell people about this, and some people will be like, oh, isn't that wonderful what you're doing? You're, you know, because, and I do rely, even though I'm not particularly religious, the Bible, the New Testament talks about visiting prisoners as one of the main ways to express Christianity. And, so they'll say, oh, you're doing this wonderful thing. You know, aren't you wonderful? But I'm getting something out of it too, out of this relationship.
Right.
And, because these people in prison do have something to offer.
Well, I agree completely. I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, my friends in prison are, it's a bit crude to generalize, but, there are forms of intelligence I have witnessed among my friends in prison that I don't encounter every day outside of those walls. And I think that's because people in prison have to survive in extreme circumstances. They have no privacy, and they've been totally stripped of so many of our identity-making accoutrements, you know, the way you dress yourself, the kind of job that you have, the family that you have, where you live, et cetera, like all these ways that people have of moving around society and signifying to others who they are. People in prison have all of that taken away from them. And yet, so all they really have is their personality. And I find that people in prison can be more charming, funnier, more insightful, more present. Just there's a level of acuity, mental acuity, that I think is required for this sort of, it's kind of a ferocious environment day to day. So that's one thing. But also, just to bring it back to literature a little bit, what you were saying about how you had not really, you know, encountered or wrestled with the idea that there's a layer of society that also warrants attention and humane treatment. I think that not only does it make a lot of sense to find a way to include those people in your life, they also deserve a place in literature. And, you know, having grown up with some people who went to prison, it's always been a story I want to deal with. But I was surprised when The Mars Room came out at how many people asked me about the research I did. And they would ask as though I had written about some extremely bizarre, little known about region of life. And why had I done that? And how had I found out the information I needed to know in order to write the book? Like, it was asked as if this were something that had nothing to do with most people's, not just their lives, but their imagined reality, you know, their consciousness. But for a lot of people, the criminal justice system takes up a huge part of their lives. And that can be because they've been subjected to it as a defendant, or it can be because they work in a prison, which if you grow up working class in the Central Valley and are of modest educational background, there's not a lot of options in terms of what you can do with a high school diploma. You can join the military or you can work in a prison. And then, you know, people who work as lawyers, people who work in the courts, it's a huge part of California. We have a giant criminal justice system. And now the people who've reached out to me whose lives are like the lives of some of the people in my novel, that's been really rewarding for me and reminds me that it is a world that deserves a place in literature. And if somebody thinks this world, you know, is far away from them and strange, then their life is a bit small, as opposed to my life being, you know, dedicated for the 5 years I wrote that book to some niche subject that is obscure. It's not obscure.
Well, one of the other things that kind of, I wouldn't say surprised me, but as I grew to know more about the prison systems and the inside workings of things, is that I think maybe I had this feeling before that if you go to life in prison, your life is wasted. if you get a prison sentence, it's, you know, it's like the worst thing that could possibly happen. It's horrible. Your whole life is a waste. And yet you can actually live a life of value with, as an inmate. There are many opportunities to help others as an inmate. There are many opportunities for friendship, and to be a good person and to grow.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had no message with this book. It's not like I'm trying to say anything in particular, and certainly nothing uplifting, God forbid. But, you know, people find ways to be vital and to crack open vitality wherever they are, even prison. And I've found my friends in prison to be capable of incredible humor. So that was really important to me, to sort of try to create characters and scenes that had that kind of humor activated in them. And I actually think it's the funniest book I've written. But also, you know, you can make a life with meaning anywhere. Does that mean I think that prison is of value for people? No, I do not think that it is. But that's sort of, you know, separate from
right,
the subject
exactly,
of
exactly.
the novel. But the main character, Romy, tries to think, I think, deeply in her way about what her life can mean, even despite having been thoroughly condemned by the juridical system. So if you're given a life sentence, what can your life mean? And that sort of comes up very dramatically at the end of the book when she's thinking about her son and everything that she says. And I really relied on my own reprisal of certain ideas of the philosopher Nietzsche. He has this concept called love of fate. And for me, it took on a new meaning when I was writing this book as a way for a person with a condemned fate to regard their destiny in a very active way, like to take charge of it, to love it, even despite it having been set upon them so that it's originally something passive, like to turn it around and claim it and then do something with that claim.
Before we run out of time, let's hear a little bit from the book.
This is a scene when the narrator, Romy Hall, is first arriving at a prison in the Central Valley of California. It's a women's prison, and she arrives alongside a person named Conan, who is a transgender man. They gave us one-size-fits-all polka-dot muumuus, and three-sizes-fit-most canvas slippers. Even big and burly Conan was forced to wear a muumuu. He threw his shoulders back to show the cops the muumuu was too small. I need pants and a shirt. I can't wear this. It ain't right, Sarge. He kept raising his arms. It's too tight in the shoulders. Lieutenant Jones said, "What are you planning to do in it, ma'am? Conduct an orchestra? Shut up and put your arms down." The muumuus made me think of that expression, lipstick on a pig. No woman should be compared to a pig, nor made to wear the garment they gave us, and no Conan either. We were chained to a bench in a hall, waiting to be interviewed in a little concrete room about drug use, sexual history, mental health, and whether or not we had gang affiliations or enemies currently serving time at Stanville. After several hours of this, they gave us each a bedroll and a California Department of Corrections offender's handbook, as well as a 40-page guide to the California Department of Corrections offender's handbook. Conan wondered out loud if we would also be getting a guide to the handbook. "The failure to report a rule violation," Conan said in a nasal voice, "is also a rule violation. The failure to report a rule violation of a failure to report a rule violation is another rule violation." Lieutenant Jones said, "Not even 6 hours in prison, and you just earned your first 115.
I figured she was being sarcastic, but she went over to the cop shop and started writing him up. Some of the girls laughed and snickered that Conan was getting written up. You'd think we would band together. Even our ragtag crew from the transport bus, with all 60 of us, we could have subdued the two cops easily enough, hijacked that vehicle, and gone to Mexico. But there was no cooperation, just people eager to see others fall under the hammer they suffered under themselves. Jones read the guide to the handbook and then the handbook itself. There were rules about everything, appearance and thoughts and letters and language, food and attitude and scheduling, tools and implements and use. Many instructions on who not to touch, anyone, or where, nowhere, and certainly no fornication was allowed. "What is fornication again?" Conan asked. "It's just fucking, right?" Jones began deciphering for us loudly the signs in the day room, since we were all presumed dyslexic or illiterate. The signs all began the same way. "Ladies, report to staff if you have a staph infection. Ladies, no whining. Ladies, out of bounds results in an automatic 115. The warning shot sign was more blunt. No warning shots in this area. The clock on the wall had a red wedge from 5 minutes to the hour until 5 minutes past the hour. This was for the women who could not tell time. Jones explained the red wedge. "All you need to know," she said, "is when the big hand is on red, room doors are on unlock." Everything in prison is addressed to the woman for whom the red wedge is painted on the clock face, the imbecile. I've never met her. Plenty I have met in prison cannot read, and some cannot tell time. But that doesn't mean they are not shrewd and superior individuals who can outsmart any egghead. The imbecile the rules and signs are meant to address is nowhere to be found.
Rachel, let's talk a little bit about Romy and how did she come to you more or less fully formed, or did she develop as you wrote?
That's a good question. It's really in the tone. I think it's the way that she speaks. It's her voice. It's the first person. And, I'm really interested in the first person, but there's so many different kinds of first person voices. And this voice I think of as within the tradition of the confessional or the testimony. Like, she's not speaking to a specific audience. She's certainly not speaking to a judge. But she does speak as though there were a listener, and she confesses certain things, shares very private thoughts with the reader, but she also doesn't divulge everything. She speaks in a kind of clipped and wry and syncopated way, and she's reporting on what's going on around her in the beginning of the book. When she's on the bus and, you know, sharing what people on the bus are saying to her, and, at the same time, skipping back and forth between the bus and her memories of scenes in her so-called free world life before prison. And it's the way that she goes back and forth without any apology or kind of throat clearing. "Oh, this reminds me of a time when, et cetera." She just goes back and forth. And it was the ability to do that freely, I think, that allowed me to really develop her voice. So it was kind of in the technical considerations of the writing. And she's also a girl from my neighborhood in San Francisco. She grew up in the Sunset, as did I, basically almost on my street, a block away. And her adolescence is one that I know intimately. Her friend group is my friend group. And the reason that I did that is I needed a character who had a believable and richly detailed past, because I figured that's all she really has to fall back on and think about once she's in prison. So I need to have a real depth of understanding of who she is. And also, she is like so many girls I knew. And although what happens to her and that she does, the crime she commits, is somewhat extreme, it's plausible to me. I could see it happening because I, you know, knew scenarios like it. She works in a club, the Mars Room, which is based on a real club, which was Market Street Cinema. And the way this guy starts paying obsessive, unwanted attention to her is very believable to me. So, and then she's, the way that she's tough, is written in homage to people I was close to whose lives went really differently from my own. And so I guess in a certain sense, the book was for me a way to ruminate on or try to bring closure to those differences.
Is there a little bit of "there but for the grace of God"?
Well, not exactly, although it is a fair question and I've been asked it. No, in fact, I mean, I think that's one of the things that can be sort of devastating or guilt-producing about reality is that, you know I would not have gone to prison. Mm. And I knew that when I was young, but I was surrounded by people who, as I thought of it, were free to destroy themselves. Mm. And I was not free to do that.
Wow. Well, tell us, Rachel, a little bit about Gordon Hauser and his role in this book and where, and also, you know, the whole Kaczynski element.
Oh, yeah, sure. So Gordon Hauser is a teacher who ends up, he's kind of a failed academic who never files a PhD dissertation and, you know, it doesn't have the support, doesn't have the background, is from a working class family, so doesn't have a tradition of education and ends up getting a job working for the California Department of Corrections, which, by the way, is always hiring. So he ends up teaching English in the women's prison where Romy is serving her sentence. And the women in his classroom kind of humiliate him, and he knows it and is interested in that process of humiliation because it's kind of like an educational formation for him. He's naive about many components of their life, as frankly any educated person walking into a prison would be, because it is an institution with logic and rules, and you cannot know those rules unless you live in that institution. So, but yeah, of course, he's much more educated than they are. And I wanted to have a character like Gordon who would be coming and going from the prison and could tell the story of what it's like to go in and have the rules be not legible. And also, he lives in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada and drives down to the city in the Central Valley where the prison is located. And to me, this is a part of the story. And although Gordon and I have really not very much in common at all, I drive regularly to these prisons in the Central Valley and seeing them. And for instance, like when he first drives to the prison, he sees in the middle of these night black industrial farmland fields, he sees this bright light, like daytime, sodium orange lights. And it looks like, I don't know, an oil refinery or some kind of factory. And why is it at full operation, you know, at 1 a.m? But he knows that it's the women's prison. Just as when I see those lights off the Highway 99, I know it's the prison. And it's somehow, it's just a part of the story of California, the geography and the truth that can be found in these geographic features, the built landscape and the natural landscape. And so Gordon is kind of there to to provide that dimension of the story, which to me is essential to understanding the whole.
Mm. And his sort of interest in Krasinski?
Yeah, so he was getting his, Gordon was writing a dissertation on Henry David Thoreau and Walden, and jokes to a friend of his when he ends up, you know, kind of taking a step down in his career ambitions by, instead of becoming a professor, working in a prison, he sends a friend an image of the cabin he's going to rent and says, it'll be my Thoreau year, because he signed a one-year contract at the prison. And from what I understand, that's a kind of parlance that's used by, you know, kids who go to nice Ivy League colleges and then they take a year out in the woods and call it their Thoreau year. And he's calling his year working at the prison his Thoreau year. And his friend looks at the picture of the cabin that he's rented and writes him back and says, your Krasinski year. Which, you know, as we know, Henry David Thoreau lived in a cabin at Walden and Ted Krasinski lived in a cabin in Montana. And I have a friend, he's an amazing filmmaker named James Benning, who had made this artwork, which is comprised of, among other things, exact replicas that he built of Thoreau's cabin from Walden and Krasinski's cabin from Montana. And it was a complex undertaking of comparing those two people who ultimately are quite different and yet do share certain similarities, which might be summarized as their interest in solitude, nature, self-reliance, and fourthly, the technological destruction of the world. But they go in different directions with it. And Krasinski went in a very dark direction. My friend James Benning owns Ted Krasinski's diaries. Somebody else purchased them for him at the FBI auction, the proceeds of which, I should say, went to the victims of Ted Krasinski and their victims' families. But the diaries are really quite interesting in the way that they go from this more Thoreauvian account of surviving in the woods, eating porcupines, you know, drying meats for the winter. They go from that to anger at, for instance, the snowmobilers, you know, a few miles away in the winter in Montana, and how profoundly he feels his autonomy is infringed upon by these snowmobilers. So nature for Ted, if I may be on a first name basis with him, is not necessarily a solution to the problem of the human, although he hoped that it would be that. But he gets so angry that he breaks into the snowmobilers' cabin, trashes all their stuff, sets their snowmobile on fire, and empties out all their bottles of vodka. As a friend of mine said, you know he's serious when he emptied out those vodka bottles. And then turns toward really wanting to hurt people. And I transcribed some parts of the diaries, and I was very struck by his tone and how different it was from my own tone. I could not have emulated the voice of Krasinski. I mean, I probably could have, but not to the degree that, you know, I couldn't have made it like his passages. And so I chose five of them and put them in the book. And I guess the inference is that Gordon is reading them. His friend gives him a Krasinski reader as a joke. And the presumption is that if he's reading those diaries from the reader, but in fact, that reader doesn't exist. And those diaries have never been published, only in my book.
Oh, wow. It's true. I'm just looking at some of them, and he's got a pretty dark perspective on the world.
Yeah, he's a very angry man who wanted to kill other people. And as he says in one of the passages that I chose, he doesn't pretend to have any more moral justification for this.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today has been Rachel Kushner, author of The Mars Room. Rachel, let's talk briefly. We always like to kind of ask about your path to publishing. So your first book, you said, was published in 2008, And was it, did you have a normal first novel struggle to get published, or did you have one of those lightning only strikes once events?
I would say I have been pretty fortunate, you know, knock on wood, all the way along. I had been in contact with an agent before I wrote the book, and she said to me, you know, get in touch with me when you're finished. But it took me so long to write the book that by the time I was finished, I assumed that she would have forgotten all about me. And her name is Susan Gollum. And when I finished the book, I called her and was trying to explain who I was and remind her that she had agreed to read it. And she said, oh, yes, of course. She's like, where have you been? And I said, you know, it took me a lot longer than I thought it was going to. And I couldn't rush the process. And I worked with her. She's a really great editor. I worked with her on revising the book so that by the time she submitted it to editors, it was very close to what was published. It was really almost what was published. And so she wanted, you know, to send it out with a very strong vote of confidence. And Susan is a great agent and had editors who were willing to read manuscripts that she submitted quickly, I think. Wow. So she got responses very fast, within a week. And then I ended up working with Nan Graham, who is my editor at Scribner, who's an amazing editor. She's also a publisher, so she has a very kind of anchored position within the publishing house where she works. And I really liked her, and I felt she appreciated me and my sensibility, and the book, of course, but also seemed like a very old-fashioned editor in the sense that she signs on with the writer and not just with that project. So I ended up working with her, and I'm still working with her. Welcome. And my agent.
That's fantastic. Congratulations. While you were writing, you know, spending those many years writing that first book, were you confident that you would be able to publish?
No. Oh. I mean, I had no reason to be confident because you just don't know, I think. Oh. And the novel is such an inchoate, if I may use a kind of fancy word, you know, it's a process where you're in the dark and you're in profound doubt. And I think that that's a necessary part of the process. It's not paint by numbers, right? You don't like write an outline and then just complete each bullet point. You have to undergo a set of transformations that you couldn't have predicted. And yet, as the cliche, you know, is rounded out, and yet comes to feel inevitable. So I didn't even know I'd be able to finish writing the book, much less publish it. And once I finished it, I didn't know if my dream was going to be a shared dream, if other people would recognize the achievement of it or see the literary merit of it. Publishing one, I could say, is helps a lot in the future.
Of course.
With knowing that you have at least, you know, the masochism and the patience to finish a book. But no, I mean, I just think there's no guarantees.
Well, thank you for being with us today. We're out of time. And congratulations on the paperback publication of The Mars Room. And we look forward to seeing your next book in about 5 years. Is that accurate?
I think so. Yes, it is. I mean, as you know, as if the past is any indication, thanks a lot for having me on your show.
You're very
nice
welcome.
Speaking with you.
And we usually close with the quote that my mom finds, but since she's not here today, I found one from Henry David Thoreau that I think is apropos. The price of anything is the amount of life you exchange for it.
That's amazing.
And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.